Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg, editor of the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael. And our topic today is veterans. We're going to talk about veterans and all the issues that they face. Our guests are Larry Catt, who's the Veterans Service Officer from Monroe County, and the man he replaced, John Tilford, who previously held that position. John is a retired Army Reserve Colonel. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. Or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Larry, John, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, welcome back, John. And Larry, welcome for the first time.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I mentioned John's service, but Larry, why don't both of you talk a little bit about your own service and, you know, why you have chosen to be in veterans service?
Well, I enlisted in the Army in 1966 and retired in 1994 as lieutenant colonel. And I think along the way I was with the 82nd Airborne to begin with, which was quite an eye-opening experience. And you see what some of these veterans go through, some of the issues they face, their families face. And having been around a lot of people, service people, you kind of develop an interest in them. And there's a feeling that a lot of these people miss out on some of the support and benefits they should get. Being a veteran service officer offers you the opportunity to work with some of these people and try to see that they get what they deserve and maybe sometimes along the line correct any injustices. Mm-hmm. But it's quite rewarding for the individual in this position, and it's a real pleasure to be able to help these guys after and ladies after all the things that they've done for their country.
Mm-hmm. John, how about your history in the military?
Well, I had a, no pun intended, kind of a dumbbell effect. I was 4 years in the Marine Corps active and started in March of 65. So we have boot camp over here on my right. That's your left as you look at your radio dial. But went to Vietnam a couple of times during that time, but was very, very safe in terms of assignments. Had gone through electronic schools. We're in a mountaintop on Monkey Mountain, they called it, just east of Da Nang. And only about twice the whole time did I hear the nice little crack sound as a bullet goes past your head and doesn't hit anything, which is fine with me. And I really think I have kind of a survivor's guilt from that good luck. It was to answer your motivation question, why do you want to help veterans? Because so many of these folks I see were there at the same time I was or through similar things in World War II, Korea, Iraq, and were not as lucky. Mm-hmm. And you think, there for the grace of God, go I. But I got out of the military, didn't have a thing to do with it, came back to school, didn't have a thing to do with it, yeah, except using the GI Bill, every penny I could get out of it here going to IU. And finished, did some civil service kind of things for a while. Thought, well, maybe we'll try Reserves, National Guard. Didn't have a good time in the National Guard in the mid-70s because Guard now is great. Guard is terrific now, fully operational force, you know, terrific. Guard in Indiana in the 1970s was where the people who went in the late 60s to avoid Vietnam, just to be real blunt about it. Not all of them, but the majority. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be in that unit and tried it for a year and left. Went in the Army Reserves here in Bloomington in 79. They had a basic training unit. They had a mission. They had haircuts. They were staying in shape. They went to Fort Benning and Fort Knox and these kinds of places and didn't get out until they kicked me out at age 60 here November 2006. Mm-hmm. And along the way, got a direct commission and finished up as a colonel. My last assignment was, in theory, you understand, I didn't spend a whole lot of time there because they promoted me to say, thank you very much, get out, was Deputy Commander, National Ground Intelligence Center, Charlottesville, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. I remember when you left Bloomington for a while to go out and do that.
About three times. We left after 9/11 to go to Defense Intelligence Agency for a year. Then I applied for and got a command position of a detachment that was going to National Ground Intelligence Center. So I was home for 3 weeks. Went with them for their first mobilization, stayed a year and a half with them in Charlottesville, and that's obviously Operation Iraqi Freedom at that point. And then money ran out, and I came back and went back one last time in 2006 to help set up the Defense Joint Intelligence Operations Center, pronounced DJOC or some weird thing like this. But that was the last hurrah, the last trip to D.C., and really mm-hmm. it was about time to wind it up. Then they're so desperate for people now, they say, well, you can retire and come back. You know, they're taking these folks, a lot of medical folks especially. Mm. And I said, you can come back. We can. I said, what's the shortest period of time and where would I go? 1 year in D.C. No, thank you very much. I'll go back to Bloomington.
Yeah.
Let those younger people do this stuff. That's fine.
Right. All right. Our phone numbers today, 855-0811, 877-285-9348. And you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. We're talking about veterans, and if you have any issues pertaining to your status as veterans or anybody in your family, then please feel free to give us a call.
I have a question. You made reference to the GI Bill, and that's something that's had an impact on a lot of families. Folks have gotten an opportunity to pursue their education who wouldn't have otherwise. What's the current status of the GI Bill, and are the folks who are serving now eligible for the same kind of benefits that you were able to take advantage of?
Larry?
Well, I know it's not the same benefits that I had because at the time I was in, it was no contribution was required from the individual soldier. And now most folks select to do that, and they put money in, get money back out. There is a move, I believe, to improve the GI Bill, and I'm not just exactly sure what the specifics are on that. I know Barron Hill got in a little hot water with some people because he was encouraging them to speak to their representatives to support the bill because it doesn't have full support in Washington. And that's been one of the things also, just off to the side a little bit about veterans things, is they've received a lot of lip service over the years, but not a lot of monetary support to go with that. And I think you can look to Congress and see those people that put their money where their mouth is, and that's not always been the case. But Sean may be more up to date on that. He's kind of like an education guru, I think. And
well, there's part of this is history and part of this is current. The history, of course, after World War II, is the tuition had a living stipend in it there. Folks could not live real well, but they could live. And it paid the tuition for the school. So and again, maybe not real expensive schools, but, you know, they did pretty well. GI Bill post-Vietnam, here's your flat rate, buddy. Take your check and get out of here. So if you went to a fairly cheap school, which I was at the time, I was making money going to school. I could buy my books and pay my tuition and had money left over. That's not the case now. And the current rate for full-time is a little over $1,000 a month, but, you know, what's IU tuition alone is going to be, what, $7,000, $8,000 per semester at this point. So you can see where that's gone. Jim Webb is the driving force in the Senate, at least, for increased GI Bill benefits. And his thesis harkens back to World War II, which was, by the way, from a taxpayer standpoint, one of the best, if not the best, investment government program in history. For every dollar, I think, we've heard spent on the GI Bill post-World War II, the government got back, you know, literally thousands of dollars in increased taxes, increased infrastructure, increased engineers, anything you can think of.
Right.
Think of our parents, you know, in my case, my parents' generation that benefited that way. And the whole country, everybody benefited.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the fast forward to Jim Webb, his thesis is trying to match that. Well, it's a heck of a lot more expensive these days trying to match World War II era benefits. His plan is that, okay, maybe not Harvard, maybe not Princeton, but at least find the average of the what we used to call land-grant college, public kind of college tuition. We should be able to pay that expense, get them a little bit of money to live on, not getting rich. That should be good. Well, that's probably about twice the amount of money we're paying now for GI Bill. I think it's a great plan. It's been attacked from some other angles as being too expensive because every government program now is attacked that way because money's a problem. Ironically, partially because of the Iraq situation,
sure,
is driving that train. But there are many efforts afoot, and as we speak, people are trying to work out compromises, and something will pass. I fully anticipate some benefits going to pass this Congress pretty quickly, but maybe not as much as Jim Webb would like. And, of course, those of you who are familiar, Jim Webb knows what he was through during Vietnam himself, and his son's in Iraq now, as I recall. But we have people in Congress who are in favor of this, and it's a nice time for veterans' benefits in terms of sympathy and empathy, mm-hmm, put it both ways. But dollars is a real problem, as it always is.
Now, Governor Mitch Daniels has a reputation of as being a friend of the veteran, and you can comment to that. Is he someone that you've asked to lobby on your behalf in Washington for this kind of legislation?
I have not. Just at the state level, what I try to do when I was in D.C. those trips was to go to whoever our congressman was at the time for Bloomington, and it varied during that time, but three different times, and Lugar's office and By's office. And I would get dressed up in my little green Class A uniform and go visit, and I'd have my little PowerPoint set up and say, here's the file and here's the issue and this kind of thing. And I think it's one of the privileges we have in this country is you can hop in your car and pay $4 a gallon. I'm joking. Excuse me. Somehow get to D.C. and call them ahead of time, and they will make time for it. You're not going to talk to the person themselves probably, but you're going to talk to a staffer, which is better because who actually does the work in terms of legislation effort and guides that congressman or senator is the senior staffer for that line of work, and meet with them and tell them what you want, and they will listen to you. Mm-hmm. But I never tried the indirect stuff except that if I was to recommend one organization, which I will whether you want me to or not, it's the Military Officers Association of America, MOAA. And they changed their name a few years ago. It used to be Retired Officers Association or something. Well, it's not just for retirees, so they changed their name. Totally nonpartisan, very professional, highly respected on the Hill. So it's MOAA, and if you want to learn status, is, let's say, the best answer to your question, educational benefits, you go MOAA in your Google search, up it pops, you take a look at that and click over to the legislation status pages, and it'll give you the background, what's going on, who to contact. They even have the letter set up for you, so you can go ahead and help you to lobby these folks. What I like about them is they're so nonpartisan.
Yeah, I think one of the groups that are really very successful in lobbying, watching that sort of thing, are the service organization, AMVETS, Legion, VFW, and I know Les Compton with the AMVETS. Just left the position of state commander, but they were in Indianapolis frequently. They have a meeting they call the Big Four. I think they have the governor's ear. They watch very closely what legislation is going on. They also make frequent trips to Washington, and I think they're familiar with the people there, and those people are familiar with them, so that they can make a difference and they can put some pressure on when things are not really going the way we would like.
Could you give us a little primer on all the different service organizations? I mean, like AMVETS and the Legion. What are the differences and what are the – I mean, what are the differences between all the groups?
Well, I don't know that I could tell you all the differences. Some of them are just membership requirements. Of course, the VFW, you had to be in a foreign country, serving foreign land. AMVETS and Legion, I believe, are pretty much open to anybody that's been in the service. They do a lot of work within the community, a lot of things that people are not aware of. They help veterans. For example, we had a fellow that came back from, I believe it was from Desert Storm, that had got into some contaminant, had terminal cancer. Normally, it was taking about 10 to 12 months to get a claim through. AMVETS, I know, were real active, and again, Les Compton, in pushing this through, and were able to get all the benefits done, everything in place before the young man died and his family was taken care of. But they reach out and refer people. They do have a lot of fundraising things, but everybody thinks they're kind of wealthy, but considering the kinds of things they do. For example, I know VFW, Legion, and AMVETS here in this county share the responsibility of getting the flags out on the Memorial Day graves. And that's a lot of manpower, plus the expense on that is up around, $4,000 or $5,000. This year we're hoping the county can put in $1,000. Of course, everybody's after the county for money and stuff. But they do provide some support on that. The fireworks on the 4th of July, that's a big AMVET function. The Legion, I know, after the Memorial Day thing, had a breakfast open to the public. And so they're doing both kinds of social things, service things within the community, helping the individual, and also lobbying and trying to see that things are done right. We also use, when we file claims, we use the service organizations a lot of times as a claimant representative, and we send the files to them. They're co-located with our VA regional offices. They can watch over the claims. They can provide the people advice. They can go with them if there are appeals and this sort of thing. But that occurs at a regional level, and those people are called national service officers. But some of the organizations here are more active with having also what they call a veteran service officer who can advise individuals on stuff. Generally, because of the way things change and happen at a fairly fast pace, they will refer anybody that needs help over to my office, and we will work with them then to help them get their claims through.
Yeah, part of the reason for my question is before Memorial Day weekend, I was looking through the list of all the events in the newspaper, and there were a lot of different things that people could do, and all the different organizations were involved with one. And, you know, I was just thinking as a reader who's not that familiar with all of them, what's the difference? You know, who joins which one? So that was sort of the—
A lot of folks belong to all of them. I mean, they will. And there's guys that are, you know, every organization has a core of workers. And you'll pretty much find that these individuals that are have some involvement with each of the organizations and stuff. And, and they work, like, for example, we have the DAV van, which runs to Indianapolis, usually on a daily basis, and they help provide drivers for that, you know, and they'll oversee the program. In fact, I might mention right now, we're really hurting for drivers for that program. These are all volunteers. It takes about three or four trips to Indianapolis to get qualified, to get the physical, the TB test, background checks, fingerprints, all that. And we would like to have it set up where that a driver maybe drove only once every 2 weeks, but some of these guys are driving almost every day. And with vacations coming up, it's gotten to be a real critical point. So if anybody's interested in being a driver, if they would contact me, I could get them in touch with the correct people. Phil Deckard right now is running the program, and they can only take about five people at a time in the van, but it's provided a real help to a lot of these people and that have no other way to get to Indianapolis.
So that's to run them up to the VA hospital for their treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. I want to make that clear.
Yeah. All right. Our phone numbers again, 855-0811, 877-285-9348, and noon@indiana.edu. I wanted to talk about the range of things that you do, because I was, you know, thinking about the fact that you have World War II vets still, some around, Korea, Vietnam, the first Gulf War, this Gulf War, which I know people have some unique issues for that. So let's start back at the beginning. And what are the issues that you come into contact with in regards to the people who are still around from World War II?
Well, you want to take that, John?
Well, I'll give you just a little bit of background, the kind of basic service officer kind of theory. And let me just add a couple of things on the service organization. People sometimes think, well, I'm not a member of the American Legion, or I'm not a member of the VFW. Will they help me? Well, heck yes, they will. Mm-hmm. They'll help anybody. So it's a part of the charter with the government recognition for their organizations that they will help. Anybody must help regardless of membership. So don't be shy about that. And to agree totally with what Larry said, and also point out that here locally in Bloomington, the American Legion has wheelchairs, hospital beds, canes, whatever, for borrow, loan, or in some cases they're never going to get them back for veterans who service-connected veterans, those kinds of issues, or non-service-connected veterans. And that gets me back to my point. You have two big – here's my gestures over the radio. You have two big sides to the VA benefits program for veterans. You have the non-service-connected pension kinds of things, which includes some medical care, that kind of stuff. Then you have the guys or ladies who were injured or became ill because of their service and residual medical and other types of benefits over there. And it's a big divide. For the medical care, as an example, for a person got fairly decent income in Monroe County at this time, you know, if you're making more than, I forget what the number is now, I'd say mid to high 40s for you and a spouse, you're not going to get any VA health care. you have to have some kind of service-connected disabilities to qualify for the clinic, let's say. And why would you want to go to the clinic? You know, why would somebody go there? Because you can get, number one, fairly cheap drugs if you're going to the VA clinic. If you have even a 10% disability, which is not that hard to get, and if you have time, I'd like to get into that. You don't pay anything for the office visit to see a physician or a nurse practitioner. And your meds are costing you now $8 per month supply of basically anything they have in what they call a formulary, a list of their approved medications. Let's go for just a second or two over to the service-connected side. Uncle Sam, through the VA, is going to take care of anything it takes to take care of that service-connected disability medically. No expense to the veteran for anything the rest of his or her life at all, whether it's prosthetics or vocational rehabilitation or obviously the medications or these series of surgeries or all these horrible things you hear about from the Iraq and the improvised explosive devices. All that, of course, is going to be free treatment through the military system for a while when they're discharged through the VA system. And, of course, there's legislation trying to unify that approach, which is long overdue. But there are two distinct worlds. I mentioned pension earlier, and I always like to get the word out about this. Any veteran with any wartime service doesn't have to be in the combat. Just had to be in the military during a wartime period by one day and have 90 days, no less than 90 days total service. It has basic eligibility for pension, meaning John Tilford's really stupid and steps in front of a truck and gets, totally crippled, cannot work, and I could file for VA pensions because of, in my case, two different wartime periods, the global war on terrorism and also the Vietnam thing. Getting hit by the truck had nothing at all to do with service, but if I can't work anymore, and here's the catch, it's a needs-based system. They're not going to give me money just for being stupid unless I can't afford to live elsewhere. How can I say this? The income has to be pretty gosh darn low. But there's even a positive side to that. If let's hope that I have enough income from, let's say, Social Security disability or some other retirements I've got now that would exceed their income limit for pension, what happens when I go to the nursing home and I get, huge medical expenses? In that case, they allow the medical expenses to be deducted from the other countable income, throwing me into a situation whereby probably my other income is wiped out, so they pay me the maximum VA pension. And there's a parallel program for surviving spouses, typically widows. So if mom or dad or granddad or grandmom is in a nursing home someplace and there is a wartime service in history, people better check this out because you're talking thousands of dollars per month for this.
Can I break in there? Because I have a very specific question because my family is involved in something like this now. My father was a World War II vet and he's been dead now for about 25 years. And we actually did discover about 2 years ago that my mom, who's still living, was eligible for some sort of a pension benefit. And so it's called – you guys are going to know this – Surviving Spouse Improved Pension Benefits with Aid and Attendance. And we were – our claim was actually approved back in February of 2007. I guess my question is how long does it take from claim being approved to actually getting a benefit because we're still waiting?
In the old days, it was about 6 or 7 months, but they weren't nearly as busy. And yeah. During my tenure, so pointing toward Larry over here –
There's been some improvement in that. Actually, once you've been approved, I would think that the payment, and I don't know this for sure, would be almost immediate. I'm not aware of a delay once.
That sounds too long to me, too.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I misspoke. The claim was received in February of 2007.
Okay.
So it's been, 16, 18 months?
You're overdue. Something's wrong someplace. Right. Really, because it should be very simple. If you have your good, nice, complete claim all ready to go on, here's, proof they're in the nursing home and they're not there for fun. They're there because as their patients, makes it a medical expense. Right. And here's how much it costs and here's what their income is and here's the marriage certificate to the deceased veteran and here's his, let's say, separation form or DD-214 or World War II. They had other form numbers. That should be fairly quick.
Yeah, we can certainly – try to solve this ourselves. But I think my main point is that we didn't know about this benefit. Mm-hmm. And just like you said, we didn't know that my mother was eligible because my father was one, of course, who had served in the war. He died from something totally different from his wartime service.
But she was still a surviving spouse of a wartime service veteran.
Right. And she was in a nursing facility.
And you were not listening to WFIU on the noon edition getting this accurate information.
That's right. That's right. So that's a good tip for people to know.
There's some misunderstanding. I have some people that get rather irate because they do not get that benefit. I think right now for an individual it's like $7,438. That's just for the pension. And some people, say with a large income of $30,000, but they have a tremendous amount of medical expenses, will get down so that they can qualify that for that. Some people that are, say, making only $12,000 or $15,000 a year don't turn in any medical expenses, and they cannot understand why this person I know over there gets $30,000. I only have half that much, and I can't qualify. So they need to track those medical expenses. I know we have people that go to the drugstores. They get, you know, they'll give them printouts of all of the things they have, and they keep some records along the way of what they're spending. Now, if any of those medical expenses are reimbursed, I've also had people get in trouble for that because they report them later on. I mean, they're bouncing all this stuff against the IRS and Social Security, and 3 or 4 years down the line, then they get a bill because the initial figure they gave them wasn't quite correct. So you got to be careful. But it's worth looking into, especially in the aid and attendance is a big thing. That can make a real difference for somebody, say, that's in a nursing home or requires 24-hour care, and that would be above and beyond that particular pension.
Mm-hmm. Let me kind of belabor that point, sure. But there's misunderstanding of many of these things. And to me, aid and attendance is really pretty gosh darn, to be blunt about it, simple. And for both the veteran's pension, non-service active pension, for the veteran himself or herself if they're, you know, incapacitated, and for the surviving spouse, you have very parallel programs. All of them have three levels. Have your basic level. In the veteran's case, he's got to be totally disabled, cannot work. You have the surviving spouse level, which is your veteran's spouse is dead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all there is. The second level would be your housebound. And that's like a medical condition, maybe oxygen, maybe mobility issue or balance or many things would preclude people from leaving their home, which is fine to go to the doctor, fine to go out and get your food when you have to, but they're not out there playing tennis. You know, there's an issue at this point. They're not healthy people. And the last level is the aid and attendance, which means to live, you require the aid and attendance of another helper or series of helpers to do basic functions for you, to be real blunt about it. And, you know, you can kind of glean what I'm talking about there. It's not where, and Larry's probably had this too, people will see this, oh, well, you can get so much money from the VA if you're the aid and attendance special program, and they walk in and ask for it. No, if you're walking in and asking for it, you're not going to get aid and attendance. I don't think so. But there's only those three levels, and each one has a progressively higher income limit. But it also turns into, if you're down to zero income because you've deducted these medical expenses Larry's talking about, a progressively higher income payment. It's just the, I don't want to say inverse, but it's very, very parallel. And most people in the aid and attendance situation, when it's costing like a minimum of what, around $4,000 around here per month, you know, simple case, most World War II folks or even Korean era folks don't have that kind of retirement income. So it's going to wipe it out. So they're going to be down to zero countable income, which means they'll get the maximum aid and attendance, which is probably, I'm guessing, somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 a month for the veteran, and probably right around $1,000 or a little over that for a surviving spouse
I think we were expecting between $900 and $1,000 a month, something like that, which would help out.
The rates change every year December 1st, but they always pay at the end of the month, so January 1st would be the first bigger amount.
All right. Well, we've hit the time to take a break. We're talking about veterans issues today with Larry Catt and with John Tilford. If you have questions or comments, phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348, or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home office and garage using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2 owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. And from South Dunn Street Project, represented by Brian Lappin Real Estate, classic bungalow-inspired architecture in the Bryan Park neighborhood of Bloomington, www.southdunstreet.info. If you're a person on the go, you can take WFIU programs with you. We're podcasting. Podcasting is a convenient and easy way to download audio files directly to your computer. Listen anytime from your computer, iPod, or portable player, You can download podcasts of full-length programs like Noon Edition, Ask the Mayor, and Harmonia, or short features like Kinsey Confidential, the Ether Game musical mini-quiz, and movie, play, and opera reviews. You can find out how with a visit to our website at WFIU.org.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg from the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael and our guest today, Larry Catt, Veteran Service Officer from Monroe County, and the man he replaced, if he can be replaced, John Tilford, who held the job before Larry did. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348, or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Thank you both for all that information that was specific to my situation. Now we have a caller on the phone, another Bob. Bob, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question, and I guess it resolves around what constitutes a veteran. How do you define that? My particular case was that I was in the Air Force Reserve for 6 years. During that time, I was called to active duty for the Cuban Missile Crisis for about 30 days. And according to my DD-214, I had no active duty time. Does that make me a veteran or a non-veteran?
John?
I can try, but as you can expect, it's not a simple answer. The definition of veteran varies with the particular law you're talking about. You're going to have a law for... as an example, the non-service connected pension we were talking about, you would not qualify for that if you had less than 90 days total service. However, for as an example, just even if you had never been mobilized at all, you're going to get a, you know, you and I die, we're going to get a little flag to drape our coffin. That's a veteran. You get the free marker kind of thing if you need a free grave marker for your place. So it depends upon the benefit you're talking about. I'm kind of suspicious. If you got a DD-214, that's a separation form from active duty. So if you got that after the 30 days.
No. I did not get that after 30 days. Got that after the finish of my total enlistment. Well, actually, we were given a year off of that enlistment if we wanted to take it. I elected not to. I stayed the full 6 years of my original enlistment. But we did not get the DD-214 until after the end of that.
Yeah. Well, again, I can't give you a simple answer for it. I think, first of all, thanks for your service, because I just watched a couple of weeks ago that 13 Days in October movie, which if those of you people haven't taken a look at that, it takes you back real well to Adlai Stevens in the UN, this kind of thing. So that was clearly stressful service. And there's a very tragic case of a Bloomington gentleman who actually piloted that little whaleboat thing that went across to the first Russian vessel stopped by that blockade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I won't go into details, but I was really upset with the VA. They didn't approve his claim for a disability later. But it's the character, you know, the role was actually portrayed in the movie, the fellow last name Shippen who's there. In my eyes, personally, you're a veteran. Because if somebody holds up their right hand, swears to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, you don't know from that point forward what the heck's going to happen to you. You could have been mobilized the next day, which in your case, you were mobilized.
Right.
And if you're mobilized under Title 10 U.S. Code, that's federal money. So you're no longer... state control, reserve control, whatever, you're actually federalized at that point just as much as a soldier, airman, sailor, as anybody else ever was or will be.
Oh, sure.
So I think you're a veteran in my eyes, no doubt about it. I appreciate your service.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Bob. Thanks a lot for the call. We have two more callers on the phone. The next caller is Hazel. Hazel?
Yes.
Hello,
here
Hazel.
I am.
Go ahead.
I was just listening or half listening to the program, and... I am a widow of a veteran from World War II, and I wondered where to find out more about this that you're talking about.
Well, I would suggest you give our office a call if you're able to stop by, to come by, and we'll be glad to go over your husband's record and to talk to you about what possibly might be available for you. We prefer to work on an appointment basis because a lot of the conversations we have are dealing with confidentiality.
Sure.
But we do take people on a walk-in basis, so if you happen to be in the area and you want to come by, that's fine. Our number is 349-2568.
Wait just a minute here. 349, what was the last?
2568.
2568.
I'm employed part-time by the county. I'm only there until noon each day, from 8 to 12. I have assistants who are as capable as I am, I'm sure, of answering any questions and doing whatever I do. They are there from Monday till 3 and Thursday till 3. So if you came by on Monday or Thursday, you could see somebody up till 3 o'clock. And we are located in the Curry Building. We just recently moved from the Health Services Building.
Okay, and that's on 6th Street, is it?
7th Street. It's 7th. Right down from the Justice Building, west of the Justice Building.
Okay.
All right, Hazel, good luck.
Thank you.
All right, John, did you have
I was jumping up and down because I appreciate, first of all, Larry giving the good information out of where to find this. And I know it bothers Larry when we help people and it's very satisfying, and then you think, okay, this has got to be only the tip of the iceberg, mm-hmm. which is one reason for really appreciating being here today to get word out about veterans' benefits, because so many of these people, again, come from a generation that didn't want to accept things. And I always tell them, hey, buddy, who cares about you? Do it for your family. Mm-hmm. You know, do it for your spouse or kids or whatever. File a claim. But I wanted to get your attention before I get off here. It hit at least three things really hard, and then I hope we have some more questions. First, a lot of Vietnam guys come back. You had, I'm trying to think how many people were actually in Vietnam at one time for a short while. It's got to be obviously hundreds of thousands because mm-hmm. I was there. You had, a quarter million people there at the one time. But a lot of folks in through Vietnam. Anybody who had one foot, I'm exaggerating a little bit here, were in country in Vietnam for even one day during the wartime period are automatically assumed by the VA to have been exposed to Agent Orange. And there's a list of disabilities which are automatic. VA would cringe if they hear me say this, but it's true, are automatically rated. All they got to do is claim it is disabled for those particular disabilities as being service-connected. Then the big ones that I can think of immediately are prostate cancer and a diabetes type 2, adult-onset diabetes. And a lot of people get these things just as they get older anyway, but it turns out that people who were in Vietnam get them a heck of a lot more than higher rate than the population as a whole. So I watch that PSA, and I encourage the other guys out there to, too. And the think sucker goes out. You get diagnosed. If you got a little cancer, you catch it early for treatment, but also you immediately file your claim with the VA for a service connection for that, and you're going to get it. Guaranteed you're going to get it. And same thing for diabetes type 2, which can be nasty if you let it out of control. And you have secondary disabilities. No, you don't want secondary disabilities from diabetes type 2. You want to catch it and keep it medicated so you don't get the vision problems, kidney problems, heart problems, et cetera. The goal is here not to get more money out of being disabled for a higher percentage. No, that's not a good idea. And that gives me indirectly to the second issue in terms of benefits on the service-connected side. Somebody gets a service-connected disability, only 10%. And I think my first disability was an ankle I screwed up playing basketball. You know, obviously a real combat-related wound, right? But, you know, I can still walk and do things, but it's some things I can't do anymore. I get a 10% rating for that. Not only does it get me into the clinic, regardless of what my income is, the VA clinic, not only do I not pay for the doctors, I just want to go there with a sinus problem like I'm about to get now from cutting grass when it was a dusty day, but I get a little bit of compensation for that, or I would, except as offset for my retirement. Now, but if somebody's not retired military, they get, what is it, $115 or $117 bucks a month for 10%, whatever. Let's go to the county level. The county, because I'm a disabled veteran, I proved that over there in the auditor's office, second floor. Susan Floyd's good at it. Christina's good at it right there in the office. So here, look at what the VA gave me, 10% rating for this. Oh, here's an extra $24,600 and some bucks off your property assessment, and it saves me about $400 a year on my property taxes. Even at the 0% level. Now, 0% for a service connection is not a turndown. It just means you're disabled in some respect from your service. It's not quite bad enough to justify 10%, so here's your 0% rating. With that, the Child Disabled Veteran Award here at Indiana University or any other Indiana state-supported school pays all their tuition and fees. So my kids got to go to school basically, well, one didn't take advantage of it, but right here in Indiana, university campus where we sit now, free. Now, they got to buy books and they got to eat and they got to sleep someplace, but that's a heck of a deal. That's for Purdue. It's for all the regional campuses of the schools, all the Ivy Techs. What am I missing? University of Southern Indiana.
Ball State. Ball State.
Thanks. All these. Follow that. And there's different names for Child Disabled Veteran, Remission of Fees. Only for the kids of. The veterans themselves don't get it. Only for the kids of Service-Connected Disabled Veterans of the Wartime Service or Purple Heart recipients. or prisoners of war for a certain period of time minimum, which I'm not familiar with that one. Heck of a benefit. And then lastly, and I'll leave you alone, you can actually do your job over there, is a few of us have been thinking about this for a while. I'm getting real serious about it now because I'm going to try to hijack one of Larry's columns on what they call honor flight. And if you haven't seen this in the newspapers, just do a little Google search and put in honor flight and see what pops up. There's a national organization that flies World War II veterans to see the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. And just think about that for a second, how touching that is. Some, you know, there's a national organization, you apply to that directly as a veteran and you're ranked with everybody else, and that's nice. However, there are also communities scattered throughout the country. They're doing exactly the same thing, same title. There's even online a honor flight for dummies kind of a deal, which so people here in Monroe County can do this thing and borrow other people's experiences to do it. And I think we should. I think we ought to see if we can get enough veterans to contact, ironically enough, Larry's office at 349-2568 and say, yeah, I'd go. So the question is, do we have enough Monroe County veterans who are willing to take a free ride to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial? And we'll have to have, they call them guardians. There's about a ratio of maybe 1 to 3 helper people because some of these folks have wheelchairs or walkers or medications, and some don't. Some are fine. They can take care of themselves. And take them as a group, and we charter an aircraft, and we land at, I hope, National Airport because it's more convenient. And you charter a little, these tour buses will take any kind of money they can get, as you well know, because they'll arm wrestle you to get on the tour bus. But those folks to go to the World War II Memorial, some of the other local memorials close by, like the Vietnam, the Korean, maybe stop at the Capitol, stop at Arlington National Cemetery. I hope when we lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which is free, by the way. Anybody can do that that applies ahead of time. Done that about 3 times now. And I just want to do that for the Monroe County veterans.
Yeah, and John will have a column. He's going to, as he said, he's going to hijack Larry's column space, which is in the paper every other week, about veterans issues. So you'll be reading more about that.
I just got back from Washington, actually, and saw that exact thing playing out. It was very touching, very, very exciting. I hope that that can happen locally.
All right. We have a caller on the line. We're going to get to Robin next. Robin?
Yes. My father, born in 1923, served in World War II in the European theater, Battle of the Bulge, et cetera. He is now stuck in a reclining chair. He can't even lay down. But it's not a result of any injuries of war. So everything you're talking about right now doesn't pertain to him. Is that correct?
Potential exception of medical care, because it sounds like he's got some issues. And
right.
And certainly his military service alone, regardless of any service-connected disabilities, would qualify him for the basic medical care if he meets the needs test. They have a needs test for non-service-connected people for medical care. And, of course, the answer to all these questions is to apply and see what happens. If he does not apply for medical benefits, and Larry can add the specifics on this, I think it's a VA Form 1010 for basic medical benefits. And attach a copy of the separation form and ship it into the VA medical people and say, sure, you got it. That might include medications. It might include adaptive equipment. It might include who knows what's suitable for his case. Might. But you never know until you apply and find out for sure.
Larry?
All right. Thanks, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one thing that most veterans expected was medical care. Due to budgetary considerations, they've broken the veterans down into 8 priority groups. Priority group 8 consists mostly of those people without any service-connected disabilities. If you hadn't enrolled in the program by 2003, I believe it was January 16th, you're no longer eligible for benefits along there. And we've had in fact, we've had people that had appointments scheduled. I've gone out and looked at their letters and stuff. All their appointments were canceled, and they were no longer eligible because of those restrictions. And that's one of the shocking things. But I still agree with John. You should let somebody else decide you're not eligible. If you think there's a chance, you should come talk to us, or you can go by the clinic and get that Form 10-EZ. And fill it out, and it's not that difficult.
I'm just now trying to visualize the Form 1010 in front of myself, and I realize there's a little medical expense section on that form. So a person reports, I don't know, pick a number, $50,000 income, But if they're paying out, you know, another $20,000 in medical expenses, which is not that hard to do these days, then the countable income can be reduced right there on the application form. Mm-hmm. So there are ways to get to eligibility which are unpleasant ways, but they still exist.
Right.
So the answer is to still apply and provide all possible information, see what
all
happens.
All right. Yeah, Robin, give them a call. Our phone number is 855-0811, 877-285-9348, and noon@indiana.edu.
Here's an email that came in. It says, what's on the top 10 list of benefits that are off limits to gay and lesbian soldiers? Because Veterans Affairs doesn't recognize their families, their same-sex partners and partners' children as families.
Well, I'm losing that. I don't think there is a problem there as far as veterans' benefits. Nobody asks them. Nobody cares as far as applying for benefits. And I've had gay and lesbian people in the office, and they would come in with almost combative attitude saying, we're going to turn me down. I say, what for? You know, we fill out the forms and we turn in the applications and get the benefits for them. So I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. I know it'll be hard to answer through the email here in print in front of you, but we don't care. You know, as far as the benefits issues, what we may be making reference to, of course, is don't ask, don't tell in terms of people on active duty being discharged when it comes up. And that's an issue.
I think there may be a reference to their partners or children as well.
Oh, where they would qualify as legal children for dependents or mm-hmm. for children's benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I can't speak to that. I haven't had that circumstance that I knew of.
Do you – yeah, do – can – if your children – if you never married the father or mother of your children
– good point.
Are they still counted as your children if you can prove it that they are your – in fact, your children?
I doubt it because I'm thinking the Indiana law on common law marriages is a male-female law.
Mm-hmm.
So the – again, which is not a problem for the VA common law, but that's still male-female. So so maybe there is a problem there. I didn't realize.
I don't know that there'd be a problem, though, with adopted children. If a person has adopted a child.
Oh, a legal adoption.
Yeah,
that's a very good point.
And that one of the things is like on remission of fees. Adopted children can receive that. I forget it has to be a certain age, and I don't recall that they have to have done that. But if a service member has an adopted child, there's no requirement that they be married or anything. So
what you're both saying basically is on these forms it doesn't say sexual orientation anywhere.
No.
So if they are veterans and they have children, now their same-sex partners doesn't.
They won't get the spousal benefits.
Yeah. No,
they won't.
But the adoptive children thing
right.
sounds good. I think Claire's a good point.
Spousal benefits are out of still not an opportunity or not an option.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have another phone call, and it's Pete. Pete?
Yes. I have a question about the World War II widow's benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Just one wrinkle on that, and that is the fact that my father, after 17 years, I think, divorced my mother. She never remarried. She's now, you know, a divorcee sort of widow. does that divorce affect that circumstance?
Well, the bad news is, yes, it does. And
okay.
I had an occasion, a friend of mine, a good friend, didn't bother to tell me that his mother had divorced his dad before he passed away. You know, we went through the application form and got down to the last portion of when did you marry him, and it only ended up with his death, right? Well, no, he ended up when he divorced me. Well, excuse me very much, but we can
Goodbye.
Go ahead. I can help you. We can fill this form out and mail it in, but it's not going to do any good because not only a person who was, let's say, divorced from the veteran at the time of being sexist here, assuming as a male veteran at the time of his death, but even if the lady in this case had left the guy and was no longer cohabitating at the time he passed away, they'd have a real burden to prove that there was a marriage relationship there for the veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Nice lady, good friend of mine, did everything I could come up with trying to help out, and I had a brick wall.
Well, what you may be. In addition to that, and that is, can a person find, like, I have no idea where my father's DD-214 would be.
Yes.
I'm sure there are a lot of people in that kind of circumstance. So,
let me hit the marriage, or excuse me, the widow thing real quick. I'm having a senior moment here, then have Larry do the I know he's, I can see his eyes now. He's thinking standard form way. I can see it from here. But what you may be thinking of the divorce situation is military retirement pay. And somebody who's married to a fellow who, being sexist again, who put in 20, 30 years in the military, divorces him, they do have a legal draw on part of that military retirement pay. which was passed here, what, about 20-some-odd years ago, and some people aren't aware of that. But I'll shut up and go back to Larry, and he's getting the information on your dad.
214s or discharge papers, sometimes they're in the earlier days, they went by different nomenclature, can be obtained. You could come to our office if you're having problems locating them. A lot of military people had them placed in a recorder's office. I don't know. That was when I got out. They recommended that you put it there for safekeeping. They no longer recommend that because of identity theft. Indiana is one of those few states that I know of that has taken some precaution and no longer release those records just to anybody. You have to show that you are the person. Sometimes the recorder comes down, and we work very closely with us, and we'll verify that the person has a need. They can be requested out of the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis. Some of their records, the top floor of that office building burned off back in the 70s, and so some of those records are not available. There's also the archives up at the state where they can be obtained. So there are a number of locations where we can run them down. It just, you know, may take a few weeks or so to get it, but it's not very difficult, and it is a common request that we receive.
I would have thought so. My father remarried, so there's another widow who's a real widow, but the question would be for a person in my circumstance, how in the world do you find an ancient document like that? I'm not even sure where my own DD-214 is, and it's from the late 60s. So.
Pete, give him a call,
349-2568. Thank you so much.
If I know we're running short of time,
one
I
minute.
Want to throw in something really quick. People see the Walter Reed deals or these other Wounded Warrior kind of things and think, oh, my gosh, this medical care is horrible. We're giving a return people. Not exactly true. The great majority of it is very good medical care. There's some of these folks are understaffed and, or the facilities are understaffed, and I had a couple of surgeries up in Indianapolis during the last year or two. Had things done to me at Walter Reed, which are not fun. I can't talk about. Bethesda, et cetera, and I have never received any better care in my life than I did in those military facilities. Also over here at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, they have a marvelous hospital. Really good care. So some of these things you've got to take with a grain of salt to realize there are isolated instances.
All right. We're out of time. I want to give the phone number again, though, just in case you have any questions that didn't get answered today. You can call Larry Catt at 349-2568. I want to thank our guests today, Larry Catt, the veteran service officer from Monroe County, and John Tilford, who used to have that job. For Mary Catherine Carmichael, Ariana Prothero, and Catherine Hageman, who are our two producers today, and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.